The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratofsky, and on this week's podcast, we find out the government's plan to monitor our email and social media activity under new laws expected to be announced next month during the Queen's speech. We look at the future of the BlackBerry after its parent company RIM has decided to refocus the smartphone on the boardroom. And we hear firsthand about 4G. Will the next generation cell network really supercharge our mobile phones? We'll also be hearing what the firm who's acquired the stricken high street computer games retailer Game needs to do to keep the chain from going under. Joining me in the studio is Charles Arthur, The Guardian's technology editor. So do join us for the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Charles, welcome to the podcast. We narrowly avoided seeing the internet shut down this weekend. Is that correct?
Yes, Anonymous had said that they were going to take out all the root DNS servers, which basically get the whole internet talking to each other. And somehow they seem to have missed it, or possibly they were just too busy with April Fool things or something.
Tomfoolery.
It just never happened. And actually, that's sort of not so surprising, because you announce, yes, we're going to attack the root DNS servers, then the people looking after the root DNS servers tend to just check that they've put the padlock on correctly.
Well, and in fact, that's the case, isn't it? That there was quite a lot of investment to make sure that the internet was just, as an aside, I was watching the IT Crowd the other day, the episode in which Jen is the employee of the month. And the two IT guys write her speech and show, and she gets to show the internet, which is a box with a red light on it, to the shareholders. Anyway, so this is in fact what they did. They made the internet safer, didn't they? They invested quite heavily in the DNS.
Well, I guess in this case we can start saying, "Hey, Anonymous has saved the internet again." It's fantastic. It's great. They get to sort of save the world without doing anything now.
Well, just threatening. It's good to know. It's good to know what we're afraid of. The UK Home Office has confirmed that the government intends to put legislation into place that will require internet firms to hand over records of web use to intelligence agency GCHQ. In a move that has been criticised by Tory insiders, the coalition government has made plans to track email, social media communications and web browsing histories. Charles, what exactly is it that they intend to monitor?
They want to monitor who you talk to. So not necessarily the content of emails, but who is an email envelope addressed to. So it's to build up, if you like, their own version of Facebook, their own open graph of who everyone is talking to, so that they can pick out who the people who shouldn't be talking to each other might be.
This is, I can imagine that there are quite a few privacy campaigners who are responding negatively to this.
There's pretty much the whole of the UK doesn't seem to like this very much, although there are a few people who have been in favour of it, because it's actually easier to find people who are against it than in favour. But one person who spoke in favour of it is Anthony Glees, who's director of the Centre for Security and Intelligence Studies at the University of Buckingham. He pointed to the recent killings in Toulouse in France as grounds to support the measures, saying it needed to be done because it can be done. But to find an example,
there's a lot of things that can be done, therefore
the ends. David Davis, though, who's the Tory MP who stood against David Cameron to be the Tory leader, he's very much against the proposals. He says that they may be saying that they're not collecting content, but actually, when you look at a web page, that is content. If you access a web page, that's content. And he says it's a very, very big widening of powers, which I think will be very much resented by many citizens who don't like the ideas. And the whole idea of doing this, of this sort of monitoring, actually goes against the coalition agreement. There's a civil liberties section which says the British state has become too authoritarian.
how different is this from a Labour proposition from 2009 that was shelved because, basically because people said that it was going to infringe on civil liberties?
The key difference here is that rather than building one big central database, which sort of appealed, as Henry Porter said, to some of the sort of Marxist, statist, Big Brother Knows Best sort of influences within the Labour Party at that time, this one won't have a big database in the middle. It'll just sort of, you know, it'll be with the ISPs, and the ISPs will have to report in. So basically, GCHQ can tap into the ISPs. The ISPs aren't delighted because that puts up their prices, you know, their costs, basically.
So the ISPs are getting, well, they're having a hard time, aren't they?
They're always having a time.
Yeah, but in terms of how they've got to monitor what they're responsible for, who they have to give information to, you know, the ISPs seem to be the linchpin, the weakest point in the system.
The mobile phone companies, as we said, mobile carriers already have to collect this sort of data, things like text messages, timings, locations of phones, and obviously, you know, a lot of that will also include now data about email and so on. So they're sort of collecting that, but that tends to get destroyed after 30 days, and the police have to get intercept and, you know, other sorts of rulings in order to be able to use it. The difference here is that, yeah, ISPs don't have anything like the same sort of profit margins. And it's not as if carriers have, you know, marvellous profit margins. They do okay, but, you know, internet providers have it tougher, I think.
Well, you mentioned the 30-day rule, or at least how most mobile operators destroy the data after 30 days. I imagine that that's partially for storage reasons as opposed to for civil liberties reasons. But thinking about the quantities of data that would be coming into GCHQ, if, you know, in real time, if demanded, that's practically unfathomable. I can't even conceive of how much data that would be. Would GCHQ know what to do with all of that data?
I think they've got some quite smart people at GCHQ. There might be a sort of, you know, there might be a thinking that, oh, government, you know, they don't know anything. But actually, yeah, they got some pretty good crypto guys at GCHQ. And I suspect that when it comes to big data, that they're not so bad either when it comes to handling that. I mean, yeah, don't forget that GCHQ has for years been running the Echelon program, which looks for keywords in various bits of communication and can pick out a, you know, particular spoken or transmitted phrase in the whole email chatter, so, or, you know, or voice chatter as well. So, you know, don't think that this is beyond them to deal with.
And to that end, I when I heard this, for some reason, I just automatically assumed that they were already doing this for some reason.
So. Yeah, there was a feeling that it had sort of been implemented. I mean, that's really more to do with the carriers and the 30-day sort of information, you know, the way that this all applies there. But no, it hasn't been done with email yet.
Now, the ostensible reason for this is to fight terrorism and, you know, the bad guys, and making sure that everything is going to be okay for the Olympics, I imagine, this year in London. Will this go back after the Olympics? I mean, is this a Pandora's box?
Strange how these things never tend to get rolled back, because there's always a new threat that comes along. You know, civil liberties are one of those things where governments are very loath to sort of just roll them back for a little time. Yeah, they seem to find it convenient, and there's always a good reason why they should actually keep these sorts of surveillances going, even though the period for using them might have expired. You know, look at the US with the Patriot Act, which was ostensibly about the 2001 attacks, and, you know, which has still been going, and all the sort of things like the Do Not Fly list, you know, all that sort of surveillance, which is, you know, still ongoing and which doesn't get rolled back, you know, even though the threats might recede.
The public opinion, as you mentioned, it seems to be quite outraged. And do you think that that's going to have any effect on whether or not this legislation goes through?
I think it's going to be very tricky for them to get it through the House of Commons, because I think that they'll run into opposition from Lib Dem MPs. And once you start to get a revolt from Lib Dem MPs, then Labour is going to see the opportunity to twist the knife a bit, which means that, especially if you have people like David Davis also leading a Tory fraction, then it becomes more difficult for the parts of the government that are in favour of it to push it through.
Well, more on this for sure at guardian.co.uk. in other news, we are speed junkies, always looking for a faster technological fix. Not satisfied with the 3G network or even HSDPA, we're on a fast-forward course to 4G. But will it really satisfy us? There are currently trials happening in a few cities around the UK, and joining us down the line is Trevor Davies, a man who has had the chance to test out the London network. Welcome to the podcast, Trevor.
I'm a very lucky man, Alex.
You certainly are a very lucky man, so tell me about it.
Well, I took delivery of this dongle, which had a sign in blood 202 to take delivery of, and I caught the train down to London and got off at King's Cross and went into McDonald's. I plugged the dongle into my laptop and went through the usual network setup process. And it came up with an icon saying 4G network found, cutting a long story short. And I was surfing away at a speed faster than I get on my home ADSL 2 Plus network upstairs in a McDonald's at King's Cross.
And it was really sort of viscerally apparent. You know, you were able to sort of sense that you were going faster than the speed of light.
Well, I was getting 13 megs in McDonald's, and I get 11 megs at home. And I share my home network with four kids and a wife whose home pages on all their PCs are iPlayer and Xbox Live and all this kind of stuff. So for me, you know, when you compare it with the normal mobile roaming experience, it was fantastic.
Charles, your eyebrows practically shot through the ceiling of the studio here.
I'm just thinking about the 11 megabits at home, which I have to say is very impressive, and I wouldn't have thought is that common around the UK. For most people, they're pretty lucky if they get half of that. But you're saying, Trevor, that you're getting twice of that, and I think when you started roaming around the city, that you were doing even better than that.
Well,
and that you might have to move your home to the number 52 bus or something.
I know. I had played with this with the 4G at O2's headquarters, and I'd seen over 40 megs there. So what I did was I roamed around looking for somewhere where I would get better reception, and I did have a map showing where all the hotspots were, and you know the hot and cold places. So I got on the far end of the network was at St Paul's, and then it went all the way to Westminster. So I hopped on a bus at St Paul's, number 25 bus, as I recall, and sat upstairs going in and out of hotspots. So it was a bit of a slightly frustrating experience to start off with, because when it goes out of a 4G coverage area, the dongle itself only does 4G, so it wouldn't slip into a slower speed. But as I got down Oxford Street, I was hitting some really great numbers. When I got off, I went and had a coffee in John Lewis, and I did some surfing from there. And I found a pub around the corner of Manchester Square, where I sat, and I was getting 40 megs down and 23 megs up, which
was fantastic. That is unreal. Now, pardon my ignorance, but what happens when everybody else goes on? Will there be? Will that affect the speeds?
Will. Of course it will. You know, if I don't know how many people share a cell, I think it depends on which particular frequency has been used by that cell. But they will have the same network congestion issues and speed issues, but in a different order of magnitude. One of the things people are going to have to get their brains around is that when I did the firmware upgrade on the dongle to start off with, I went through 50 megabytes of data in just around a minute. Right? Now, the networks do not do unlimited packages with fair use policies anymore, but when they were, not so long ago, that fair use policy was 500 megabytes. Right? So the whole business model changes when you start moving to a technology that can download a lot more information very quickly, doesn't it?
How does it change? I mean, who's going to have to alter their behavior? Is it going to have to be the carriers? Are they going to have to offer more data? Or are people going to have to be really watching the clock in the way that we used to be when we had dial-up, you know, connections?
I mean, I suspect in reality it's going to be a bit of both, isn't it? Because in the long term, the network will have lots of backhaul capacity, which is the issue, and they'll be able to cope with lots of data, and the data costs will be cheap. But as long as carriers are trying to build out the network and increase capacity and continually hitting the headroom, then there's always going to be a bit of trying to price things so that people don't use as much data as they can in order to, you know, keep it sensible.
Speaking of how quickly they can get there, what is the ETA of this?
Well, the critical point in the plan are the Ofcom auctions, spectrum auctions later on this year. And I'm not sure that there's a specific date set for that. It keeps changing based on various carriers threatening to sue Ofcom for not following process and being unfair. But I think that once the auctions are in place and everybody knows which spectrum they've got, it will happen quite quickly. Because I know there is a lot of network upgrading in the middle of happening, so that a lot of these cell sites will automatically do a software upgrade to 4G rather than any physical activity. So I would expect very quickly in 2013 we'll start seeing services.
So, Trevor, the question that occurs to me is, I mean, one of the things you described in the blog post you did for The Guardian was you showed, you know, having multiple iPlayer screens open on your computer and running them. I can see for fixed 4G that, you know, for people in rural locations, for example, it could be enormously beneficial that, that you know, you'd have some sort of connector on your house, whatever, and that can bring you, you know, if that can bring you 40 megs, that's brilliant. Who's going to want that sort of speed for mobile broadband? You know, are people really going to be sitting on the bus and using it? What's the use case?
It's a very, very valid question. Remember, it wasn't so long ago that Ian Livingston of BT was alleged to have said that people don't need more than 2 megs. Okay. Now, there's new codecs, new high definition video codecs come along all the time. I think that applications will fill the void. But there are some real practical uses, and you mentioned fixed broadband replacement connections. I mean, we as a business, we're an ISP, but we're also a mobile service provider. We have customers who use 3G connections for rapid site deployment. So building sites, for example, believe it or not, the building sites these days need a lot of technology. They download plans, they transfer lots of data, and what they do is they start off digging, and they have to wait some time for the fixed line connection to come in, and so we give them a 3G router. Now, hanging off that 3G router might be several laptops and maybe a VoIP phone system. Okay. So when you get 4G in the picture, then that's going to make that kind of scenario far more useful, and I'm sure there'll be lots of other MiFi kind of applications where there'll be multiple users sharing the one connection.
Trevor, thank you very much for your time. And you can read more about the 4G network at guardian.co.uk/technology. Late last week, troubled Canadian technology company RIM announced that they were refocusing their BlackBerry smartphone on the corporate audience instead of the consumer audience. Charles, why?
RIM has just reported a really horrendous quarter. It's had its first quarterly loss in something like 9 years, lost $125 million on revenues of $4.19 billion. Those revenues are down 25% on the same time a year ago. The profits are down 114% on a year ago. It shipped 11.1 million handsets, and that is down as well on a year ago. All the numbers for RIM are going negative. And really, you can tell the whole story of where they've been going just by looking at the growth for their revenues and for their profits in the past 6 quarters. So if you look at the revenue, the numbers go 40%, 36%, 15%, minus 9%, minus 6%, minus 25%. For the profits, the growth goes 45%, 32%, minus 9%,
oh my,
minus 58%, minus 71%, minus 114%.
What happened in those crucial years when they went from plus to minus?
The key point has really been after November, the sort of November, September to November quarter of 2010. It's really sort of from that point, December 2010, really they're just getting swamped by Android and by the iPhone. They're just getting washed up. So the smartphone market at the end of 2010 grew so that it was bigger than the PC market, but RIM wasn't benefiting. They've basically not had any new idea. They've not been able to set the agenda in smartphones at all. And Torsten Hines, who has been the chief executive for 10 weeks, so not actually for the whole of the quarter, says that they're going to refocus on their core strengths. But the problem is, actually, all their growth came from the consumer market. And the consumer market is the market for smartphones. You're really not going to make any money selling to the boardroom. The boardroom actually isn't where the money's to be made in smartphones.
Is this ultimately the BlackBerry taking a hit because of the other things, like the playbook, which we've covered quite extensively in this podcast? Is this the BlackBerry sort of becoming the slaughtered lamb?
It's that the BlackBerry hasn't got anything compelling. You know, if you don't particularly want to have a keyboard, then there's so much else you can choose from. So much so that, you know, Android OS plus Apple are now 75% plus of the smartphone market. You know, and out of that, you got Apple and you got Samsung, who have about 50% of the smartphone market. You know, it's really almost a two-horse race out there. And the trouble for RIM is that while it's got sort of, somewhere in the teens in terms of share of the smartphone market, its share is falling even as the smartphone market's growing. So it doesn't have a particular USP. Why would you get it? You know, what is there that it has which no one else has?
It used to be email, of course.
It used to be email, yeah. But now everyone does that. Yeah. So that's not a strength. The BlackBerry Messenger, which is the thing that actually has been selling it to consumers and which, you know, a lot of teenagers want it for. If they're going to refocus on the boardroom, why are they turning away from them? Yeah, Horace Dedue, who's a very smart guy, runs the Asimco consultancy, says, you know, if you're turning away from the growth area, which is consumers in smartphones, then you're turning away from growth. If you turn away from growth, you have given up.
So if they're turning away from growth, does this mean that we will see the BlackBerry retired?
Before last week, before these numbers came out, I was actually thinking that I might write something about, I think RIM has still got it, that there's still something there. After the numbers came out and after I looked at the direction of all the numbers, I start to feel that there isn't actually something there. There's a sort of an emptiness. They've had no new idea, really, since they came out. You know, okay, they were great, but it's a bit like Palm. You know, Palm was a big name in smartphones in the early days. They were a big name in PDAs. They were the people who made things happen. They were the people who had an app store, in effect. Now they're nothing. You know, they've gone to zero. And I think that RIM could go the same way, because although people say, yeah, they're going to have new phones out late this year, you know, there'll be OS 10. The thing is, yeah, but what's that going to do? Is it going to do sort of, you know, like Apple is trying to do with Siri? Is it going to do voice control? Or is it going to have something like Android has, where it's so amazingly flexible that you can add any sort of, you know, interaction between apps? Or what is it going to do? Why is it going to move the smartphone market on in a way that hasn't been done already?
Well, it doesn't seem like it's like RIM is doing very well at the moment at all. And you can find out more about all of these items at guardian.co.uk. Flailing high street computer games retailer Game was pulled back from the brink this week by investment firm OpCapita. The 11th hour acquisition will save 333 UK stores and safeguard more than 3,200 jobs, according to Keith Stewart, The Guardian's games correspondent. Now, Charles, you spoke with Keith about this earlier.
Yes, Keith had an interesting 5 points of what the new owners need to do in order to keep Game alive, really.
I think the first one, and the most obvious one, is to re-establish relationships with suppliers. Up to the point where Game went into administration, it was beginning to lose supplier support because it wasn't getting financial backing from its five major lenders, so they weren't able to put into place the right kind of financial imperatives to get stock from people like EA and Capcom. So they started to lose their supplier relationships, and it's really important for the people running Game now to go back to suppliers and show them that this is an ongoing business, that they're serious about it, that the 300 or so stores that they have now in the UK aren't going to shut, and that they have the money now to start stocking their shelves properly, because I think a lot of game stores now probably going to have empty shelves because they're just not getting in the big games like Mass Effect 3 and Resident Evil. those games haven't come in, and they have to make sure that suppliers understand that the regime has changed now.
But really, their key problem was that because they didn't have those big sellers, people weren't going to go into them. But equally, even now, the problem surely is that a physical retailer has a problem, that it's difficult to persuade people to do that when they could just use their smartphone or their computer and order it off Amazon or Play or any of those sorts of sites. How does it get around this problem of being a physical retailer and trying to persuade people to buy things that they can get elsewhere? I mean, for example, I know that in my the town near where I live, there's a game shop which is not one of the chains, and it says satisfied gamers are our future. But how do you satisfy people on the high street nowadays?
Well, what you need to do is turn around that whole concept and stop thinking about retail on the high street as being an albatross around your neck, and start thinking of it as an advantage. And one of the things I've looked into when I've been writing about this story is what book retailers have been doing. And I don't specifically mean the massive chains, but independent bookstores at the moment are doing much better, and smaller chains like Foyles are doing better by bringing in, again, this idea of retail engagement and retail experience, which is bringing across the benefits of having staff in the store that know what they're talking about, having a really strong line of aggregated products. So you bring in products that your local users are going to want to play, because not all gamers are the same all the way around the country. So it's having a really, really good stock, having people in store that know about it, and creating a kind of experience around buying games, making it a kind of a social thing you want to do. Make the stores a kind of a destination rather than something which is trying to rival the websites and the supermarkets on cost, because they're not really going to win that battle. They're not going to beat supermarkets on price. They're probably not going to beat online, although the margins are actually really small. So you'd be surprised how close that a good independent or even a chain retail on the high street can get to online prices. The difference doesn't have to be that big.
Do you think that the government's ruling about VAT, that places like Guernsey won't be able to ship VAT-free discs, so I guess this must cover games this as well, do you think that's going to make a difference? Will that help the high street chains?
I think, yeah, definitely, because any way you can narrow that up cost of going into a shop is going to help retailers on the high street. At the moment, the warehouse cost of buying a game is around £35 on a big blockbuster title. So even online, you're not going to be able to get that. You're not going to be able to cut in that much more than a high street retailer has, or even though the high street retailers have to think about distribution in a different way. So, yeah, it's bound to help, because the smaller you can make that difference between online sales and retail sales, the more chance you've got of bringing customers into your store, and the more chance you've got of saying, well, come into a shop, because not only can we compete on price, but we can also compete in terms of the experience we're able to give you. And if game stores were more like the really nice independent bookstores that actually kind of greeted you in. I mean, I don't know if you know, but Virgin, this is a whole different area, but Virgin Holidays just opened a store in Kensington, and it's all about kind of retail experiences. They have iPods everywhere, so people can look up their holidays on there. They have experience points, so people can get a feel for what holidays will be like. This is like retailing in the 21st century. This is what it should be about. It should be about conjuring an experience of people in store. And to be honest, if video game retailers can't do this, if video game retailers can't use interactive technologies and demo pods and kiosks to help users experience and understand games, then really, no one else should be doing this. Video games should be at the forefront of where retail is in the 21st century, I think, and that's what game have got to get in on.
But the other problem also is that games are moving towards the download sort of idea, aren't they? Where, Nintendo, Xbox, all the platforms are moving to downloaded games. Again, where is the space for the high street retailer there? What can they do there?
Yeah, I mean, there's two things really to consider there. I think high street retailers can take advantage of digital sales. As I said in my blog post, high street retailers can sell prepaid cards for things like Xbox Live Arcade and Steam and PSN, and they can also sell cards for specific downloadable titles, games like Braid and Castle Crashers, which have done really well on Xbox Live Arcade. You can buy a card for those in-game, and in some ways, that's a reasonably nice way of doing it, because if you've got a parent or a friend coming in to buy a game for for a gamer they know. It's difficult to make those selections online, and you don't always want to give someone a piece of paper that says, I've downloaded this game for you. If you can get someone a card, it's easier to browse that experience in store. So it's a way of discovering games. But there's also the fact that, you know, there's arguments over whether our broadband infrastructure can suddenly cope overnight with, you know, 20 million gamers in this country suddenly trying to download games as big as Gran Turismo 5 or something. You know, the current PS3 games around 8 can be up to 15, 8 to 15 gigabytes. That's a lot to download. So, you know, even though in our city areas we've got pretty strong average download speeds, in lots of areas of the country it's not that fast. So if you're going to be wanting a game, you're probably going to have to leave your Xbox or your PS3 on overnight in order to download that game. Whereas the retail proposition is, if they've got a good click and collect in place, say, you could go online, order a game, go into game within 2 hours and buy it there and then. You don't have to wait for your broadband to download it. You don't have to wait for it to be delivered. That's the strength. That's where they need to focus their attentions.
So if you were to look forward 3 to 5 years, do you think that we will still see chains like HMV and Game selling video games on the high street? Is that going to persist?
That's really difficult to tell.
Those are the only sorts of questions we ask, Keith.
Yeah, I think there will be, because I think the way the industry is going is towards digital, but there's different ways in which that's going to work. And one of the propositions that some people have come up with is, okay, optical discs are dead for video games because Microsoft possibly won't get on board with Blu-ray, although there's rumors just coming out that the next Xbox might well have a Blu-ray player. I'm not sure if that will happen, but I still think within a couple of years, games just aren't going to fit on discs. So I think that maybe the future is in some sort of memory stick format. If that happens, there's a possibility for high street retail to maybe have download hubs where you could, instead of having to go through this process of downloading onto your own machine overnight, if you want like 3 or 4 games over a weekend, well, that's a whole weekend that your PS3 is going to be shut down, downloaded that stuff. Maybe what you can do instead is take a blank memory card into a store like Game and download a game onto it there. You know, memory cards can go up to, what, 40 or 50, 60 gig. So that's one way that the stores can still remain part of that whole kind of digital loop. So that is a possibility, and maybe that's something that people like Sony and Microsoft are looking at, maybe making games available in that way. And that's helpful as well because it rules out things like, you know, piracy, and they can control distribution a bit better. But I think, in general, although there are too many shops on our high streets at the moment, and that's an ongoing thing, and that's, you know, that's never going to, the way the high street was 2 or 3 years ago, that I don't believe that's ever coming back. And all the retail analysts I've spoken to have said, no, that's not coming back. But we're social, we still like going out, we still like sharing, we still like meeting each other. And I think game shops can be a part of that if they get that whole kind of social experience thing right. And I think that is true now, and I think it will be true in 5 years.
Keith Stewart, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's podcast. Many thanks, Charles, for being in the studio, to Trevor Davies and Keith Stewart for joining us down the line. Links to all the stories are available at guardian.co.uk/techweekly, where you can also listen to our extensive archive. We're 5 years old this year. Did you know that, Charles?
It's incredible.
5 years. That's long. And you can also find out how to get in touch. We're back next Tuesday. Producer this week was Jason Phipps. I'm Alex Krotowski. Thank you for listening.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.